Welcome to Access Advocacy on thepowerofvoices.com. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. The goals of Access Advocacy are to improve the lives of patients and caregivers who are dealing with the chronic illness of sickle cell disease. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Stephen Froelich, a licensed marriage family counselor. I often say that he's the man who saved my life. And I'm saying it right now. He is the man who saved my life. As I was going through a collective life of many traumas of raising Marissa with sickle cell, and I was having real life hitting me at all ends. And after going through several counselors, I found Dr. Steve. And I think one of the few people who can say, I found someone who not only helped me while I was in crisis, but gave me the tools so that I could go forward and make a better life for myself. So thank you again, and welcome, Dr. Steve.
Oh, Adrienne, thank you so much.
Well, we're going to talk today about, we'll do a little bit about you, but really most of today's conversation will deal with crisis, and you are an expert in crisis. Tell us a little bit about your I would say crisis counseling and life management. Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Adrienne, you know, I believe, as you know, that life's a journey, and I am so, first of all, I'm so grateful to be here with you today, and I believe you gave me far too much credit for your resiliency and ability to manage through some horrific crises. Which takes us to why you've asked me to talk a little bit this morning. I started having a traditional psychotherapeutic practice, but as life would have it, I was pointed in the direction of working in the first responder world of particularly fire. And I've been fortunate enough to be a contract mental health with the County of Los Angeles Fire Department's Critical Incident Stress Management Program over the last 20 years. And that's led me to a little bit of a new role, which I started just a few weeks ago as the Director of Behavioral Health for the United Firefighters of Los Angeles City. And really, what that means is that because of the population that I serve, a population that deals with one traumatic incident after the next, shift in and shift out, I've had an opportunity to come to understand what happens with us humans when we're faced with trauma, and what happens when we're taken out of that ordinary world that we prefer to live in, a world that has some predictability to it, where our personal defensive structures hold up and take us through each day. And then in this other world, in this world of trauma, you have events that are so horrendous, they're so dramatic and traumatic that they have a way of breaking those defense mechanisms down, and we're flooded with the anxieties and fears that come along with, you know, tragic events, and we have, for that moment, we have no way of coping with that because it's so overwhelming. And so really all that I've learned to do for people who are having that experience is in so many ways just to normalize it. Those are normal reactions that happen in the body and in the mind after having these horrendous exposures. So whether it's an earthquake, whether it's a fire, whether it's a flood, you know, we can all think of the tragedies that have happened in the world, and people are exposed to those. From one minute to the next, they go from being safe and comfortable in their normal routines to having everything just sort of blown up, and nothing is where it's supposed to be. And the normal feelings that would come up would be the human instinct for survival. So it would be the fight or flight instinct, and that's a good thing because it gets you away from danger if necessary. But when there's nothing that you can do, so you're sitting in your living room, there's an earthquake, and you go into a fight or flight, there's no battle there. There's nothing to do. And all that change that occurs in the body, all that adrenaline and all the neurochemistry that changes to prepare a person to be able to survive, all of those are instituted, but there's nothing to do. And so the body has that buildup of tremendous energy, but there's nowhere for the energy to go. And as a result of that, there can be consequences for us, and those consequences are usually very uncomfortable. We typically feel very anxious and hypersensitive after being exposed to some kind of a trauma. And so you're sitting there maybe in a safe place, and yet you're still feeling threatened, and you're still feeling in danger. And there's absolutely, you know, nothing to do. Really hard. It's a hard place to be. And so what happened is we began to see similar reactions and symptoms in family members of patients who were struggling with serious chronic illness. We thought that there was only one type of critical incident, and that was that life-threatening, immediately life-threatening situation. But it turns out, in watching people who are under moderate stress for prolonged periods of time, they can have the exact same reactions in the body, and yet it's very difficult to understand that because you're just living your life. Although it may not be ordinary, it's the life that you have, and you don't necessarily think about it too much. You're just getting through what you have to get through. But that stress, that moderate stress that's sort of beating you up every day, can trigger that fight or flight reaction in the body after a certain point, and all of a sudden you're having these sort of anxiety attacks and panic attacks and not understanding, well, why? Where's that coming from? There's nothing particularly different today than yesterday. And then people start to second-guess themselves. What's wrong with me? Am I losing it here? Am I going crazy? And, of course, that just adds more stress to the situation, and it could be a little bit like a dog chasing its tail, where one panic attack leads you to the next. So I hope that gives you some insights into, I guess, my professional world and what I do.
Well, certainly, as you were speaking, I remember coming into you one day and saying, this was after Marissa had been sick, and I was having problems in my marriage, and I was telling you, I just feel like I have this hole that, you know, I'm in the bottom of the hole, and I'm just, the dirt is just coming in and piling over me, and I genuinely did not understand why I was feeling like that. Right? I mean, I remember sitting there across from you and saying, oh yeah, just checked my kid into the hospital and, you know, just had to go through having to leave my job, not be fired, but leave my work to make that decision to check her into the hospital. And oh, by the way, you know, my current mate is doing some really not so nice things. And looking at you and saying, and you know, I just don't understand why I'm feeling so overwhelmed. I just remember you looking at me and walking me through that process, which I think saying, okay, so as you said, you know, this is my normal. This is your normal, right? And your normal on the stress scale is, let's say, a 9. And here, what's going on is bumping you over normal into some traumatic stress area.
Absolutely.
And giving me that visual, right, of having that scale in my head and knowing where my normal was so that I could understand and say, oh, okay. And then from there, coming up with some coping mechanisms. And I think that for me and for the people I know and we're working with, it is the ability to understand the stress, understand what it does to you physically, psychologically, understanding why you have the stress, and then having some tools for dealing with that.
You know, it's such a powerful experience, Adrienne, that you just described, because as a human, we have the capacity to adjust and adapt to the environment we're in, and that allows us to be incredibly resilient and hardy and strong. But by the same token, once we've adjusted to an environment, let's say we're talking about that high stress environment, and let's say on a 1 to 10 scale, where 10 is the highest, you've adjusted to living at an 8. Well, that becomes, as you said, your normal, and at a certain point, you don't notice it anymore because your brain has been created to be able to go on to other things. Once it understands something, it just goes on to something else so that it can, you know, do what it does. And so here you are living your life at an 8, and that's your new normal, and you adjust to that level of stress, and you don't notice it anymore. Now, just because you don't notice it, it doesn't mean it isn't there having the impacts on your body, mind, and spirit. It is. It's there, and it's beating you up. And so the first step, and it's so important and yet in some ways so simple, is to just be able to notice that you're at that level 8 and what that means. And it's I know you described it beautifully. I felt it, and I'm sure, you know, so many others of the folks that are going to be listening to this have noticed that when you see it, you go, oh my God, no wonder I feel the way that I do. And not that anything has changed, but just by normalizing the experience, you take a load off and you feel, you feel like, hey, I can get through this because now I have a direction, and I could do some stress management. You know, I can learn how to breathe right. I can learn to make exercise a part of my daily routine or my weekly routine. I could learn to meditate. You know, I could take a yoga class. Whatever interests you and whatever stress management activity works for you, you could start to do that in a conscious way.
Well, I know that so what you set me down and you said, okay, first of all, realize right now in this moment, you are here in a safe space. And it took from me the thought that I was coming to you for help, right? So that I was needy. It took from me the idea that I was, relieve me from thinking I was broken. And under all that, it also made me feel like, hey, I am taking an action. So I took from your saying, this is a safe space, and you've gotten yourself to a safe space, made me feel that I had actually done something, even though all I'd done was get there and get on your sofa.
You say all I did. That's a pretty big deal. And when your life is feeling so overwhelming, to be able to reach out for help is huge, and it's not a small thing.
So that, I think, to me, you know, we talk about there being these 10 things to do with stress, 12 things, however many we're going to end up with, because you and I are going to do this together, this how many steps to getting through stress. I think the first would be recognizing that there is stress.
And exactly.
The second would be getting somewhere and asking for help. And there are a lot of ways now that, I mean, in the old days you had a village, right? Or you had a family. And even though we're told that in the old days people didn't talk about stress or personal things, That's not true. I remember being at my grandmom's house, and they would have the church ladies over for cake. They'd have cake and lemonade or cake and coffee, and those kids would be running around, and they would be sitting at the table, and they would be talking about their husbands and their kids and bills and you know, well, for me, the civil rights movement and, you know, all of these things. I now realize that that was kind of how they did their, that was asking for help and therapy. Where now in our society, we do have, I mean, we have people like you. We have many, many self-help books. We have the internet. We have lots of ways of reaching out. How do you approach getting those people who are having difficulty to reach out? Let's say it's not a person like me who found myself at your door of your private practice, but let's say with your firefighters, how does that work?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, because there is so much stigma about reaching out, asking for help. And so we have barriers that we have to overcome in order to be able to do that. What I've found is the most effective approach is education, you know, doing what we're doing right now, sharing, and people getting to know their resources and developing a personal relationship where if they were in a time of need, they might just feel, hey, you know what, I remember that guy, or I remember that woman. I think I might be able to talk to them and then to be able to take that step.
Do you feel that with today's society and the isolation of with technology, do you feel that is making it harder for people to make that step or that connection with the person?
Well, that's a great question, and there's a couple of different things to keep in mind with technology. You're absolutely right. Technology can separate people from one another. I mean, how many times do you see people together, but they're all, you know, texting or doing something on their electronic devices rather than talking to each other? But on the other hand, there's a lot of incredible information that's at people's fingertips because of those same electronic devices. So, you know, there's positives and negatives with the technology. It just depends how we're going to use it.
Let's say I was stressed. I've gone out. I've asked for help. And I'm at a place where that help doesn't seem to be moving me in any direction. There seems to be, when I talk to people, a lot of reluctance to either continue in a place where they're not getting something, or to just stop and say, oh, it doesn't work for me, rather than going out to find something that works. What would you say to those people who say, I've tried it and it just doesn't work for me?
So there is something, and I can't explain it, and I'm not going to try. I would just use the word, there is something magical that can happen when two people are working together and that relationship is working. And I would say just as powerful in the opposite direction, if that relationship's not working, you could have the best information, you could have gone to the best schools, but if that relationship's not happening, it's not going to work. So I would just encourage people to just keep trying. If it's not working for you with one therapist or one approach or one situation, try another one. And just stay with it until you find the one that you're able to connect with. Because when you do, that's where the magic can happen.
And I have to say that I think you were number 10 for me. Oh, well, I shouldn't share that much. Yeah.
But clearly you are a very tenacious individual, and you stuck until you found what you needed.
I say this to people, you know, I'm always quoting my grandmother, and she used to say, going to the dance ain't the problem, it's staying too long. And I tell people this when I'm trying to get them to get a counselor. I say, go and see. If it doesn't work, then leave. You know, you're Cinderella. By midnight, you should know if it's working or not. If it's not working, then you need to just leave with both shoes, right? But
yeah, and I would, the picking a therapist tip that I would share would be give it two sessions. You know, first sessions are always awkward and uncomfortable because, you know, you're opening up with somebody you don't know. So if you feel really uncomfortable, that just might be because it's a first session. But if you continue to be uncomfortable at the end of the second visit, it's just probably not the right situation, and move on to another one. And if it's something that happens over and over, then maybe it's something, you know, in you that you've got to overcome. But if it happens in one or two situations, it's probably because it's not the right place for you to be.
Yeah, right place to be. All right, so we need to take a break now, and we'll be back. This is Access Advocacy, and we're speaking with Dr. Stephen Froelich. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment on thepowerofvoices.com. Welcome back. I'm Adrienne Shapiro on Access Advocacy via thepowerofvoices.com. And today we're speaking with Dr. Stephen Froelich about trauma and finding a place where you can have true healing for your life. So there are lots of different types of therapy. People have these visions. One is of them lying in the sofa and you're talking about their dreams. Another is they're in a group with a group of people who have a shared experience or a shared conversation. There's the idea that you just analyze things, and then there's an idea that you have to do things. So let's talk about those different, I guess, flavors of therapy.
So, interesting question. yes, you are so right. There are a number of different approaches to therapy, and the studies that I've read that look at effectiveness based upon approach, they basically come back not showing significant differences between the types of therapies. And this should come as no surprise, I think, based on the conversation that we've had to this point. The one variable that correlates with a positive outcome is the relationship between the people in the room. So it doesn't seem to be the approach. It seems to be the people and how that comes together that makes the big difference. But that being said, you had described at the outset the sort of the traditional psychoanalytic, you know, patient comes in, lays on the couch, the doctor sits behind them, and they talk. And that's an approach. That's a pretty old traditional approach. That's not how I was trained. I was trained in a more, it was called humanistic existential approach. And it just meant that you engage with your client. And it's two people in a room that are doing the work together. So there's a range of approaches on the behavioral, more behavioral oriented approaches. That's where you see more of the application of learning theory to behavior. So if you want to make a change, you could set up rewards and negative consequences so that when something comes up, you get something happens that either encourages you to do it again or encourages you not to do it again, kind of like the way we raise our kids, where we're teaching them about life and how to behave and about manners and, or, you know, when to cross the street and when not to. That's the more behavioral approach. On the trauma side, there's been an interesting development, I'd say, over the last 10 years with the accidental discovery of a technique called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. That was accidentally discovered by a psychologist while walking through the woods, and as there was a flicker of light through the trees, she found herself experiencing emotion and started to investigate what that was. And so the EMDR technique was developed. I've used it in my practice, particularly with first responders, and there, once there's been a really big traumatic event for them, and other traditional talking therapy approaches haven't worked. And I have to say, each time I've used it, I've been amazed at how effective it is of eliminating the horrible emotions that the individual had been feeling prior to the EMDR treatment. So, classic story, a locomotive engineer is working. A person decides they're going to suicide using that train and jumps in front of the tracks. And now the engineer can't get back in a train because he has been traumatized by the experience. Every time he goes to get in the go back to work, he's throwing up. He just vomits and he just can't work. They tried the normal approaches: critical incident stress management, talking in a group, talking with individual therapists, and none of that seemed to help him with his symptoms. He did a couple of EMDR sessions with an EMDR specialist, and the problem was resolved for him, and he was able to go back to work. So it's a tremendous tool. It's not one that I would use on everybody, but when it's appropriate to use, it can be really effective.
Well, I mean, you've just given me a brilliant idea. Okay, so when many of us in the sickle cell community, and I'm just going to talk about sickle cell now, when we get together and we talk about our experiences, for us, the most traumatic experience we have is when we are getting ready to go to the emergency room. Now, all of us have to go to the emergency room because of the way insurance is set up. So there's very few direct admits. When we go to the emergency room, we know what we're going to be hit with. 95% of the time, we are going to go. So we'll go, we'll have a list of our medicines. Many times we're going to our hospital, but other times we aren't because we've been treated so badly in the ER. We are sent to the triage. We are made to wait and wait and wait in pain. We're not allowed to take our pain meds to the ER. So whatever pain medicine we've taken before we get there generally wears off long before we see someone. Then once we get past triage and we're in the back, we are waiting and waiting, and we're asking for pain meds, and we're really greeted like we're drug addicts. So either the patients are drug addicts, their caregivers, or whoever has escorted them there are enablers. Even when the specialist is part of the same hospital or the organization as the ER doc, the ER docs can pull up a chart and say, "I'm not comfortable with giving you the meds." I mean, and it's hours of this horrible, horrible pain, and this, it's predictable. that you're going to be going through this, where you're having to beg for care. You're having to teach who's ever there that's supposed to take care of you. You have to teach them about your disease. You have to prove to them that you're a worthy person. And you have to, I mean, it's awful. So we always say, yep, I'm going to the ER. I'm putting my armor on. You know, my thing is always I get my Wonder Woman bracelets, you know, so I can do what I have to do. And hearing you talk about that, and we know that that stress then causes more sickling, right? Because it's proven, and now they've got scans that can show that as you are under more stress, you tighten up, it restricts the blood flow, it restricts the oxygen, and all of this, of course, causes more sickling. Yeah. That maybe this might be a technique for us to use before we're having to go to the ER.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I think there's a couple of things to consider in a situation like you're describing, Adrian, and one would be relaxation techniques. As simple as breathing in the right way can create a relaxation response in the body. There's a breathing technique, it's called combat breathing. And it's just diaphragmatic breathing. They teach it in yoga, you know, all the time. And it's just diaphragmatic breathing where you inhale deeply through the nose and you hold it for 3 seconds. And you exhale through the mouth, and then you hold it emptied out for 3 seconds, and you repeat that 3 times, and that creates a relaxation response, and that's an autonomic response. In other words, it bypasses your conscious mind, and it goes directly to the body. And you're absolutely right about what happens in the body as stress and anxiety increases. It will increase pain. And as you said, it will increase the sickling of the cells. So you're getting a double whammy as your tension is increasing. Plus, you also did a brilliant job describing a phenomena that comes from expecting something bad to happen. You know, when we, and this is a thing about being human, we remember, you know, our brains remember stuff, and our brains are especially effective in remembering bad stuff because there's a survival value to remembering bad stuff because we want to keep away from it if we can, right?
Yes.
Good stuff, we don't need to remember as well because there's not so much of a survival value there, which is too bad. It also explains why we can remember all the bad things that have happened to us and maybe not so many of the good things. But if you've had these horrendous experiences with the ER and you know you're going to be going shortly, then it would be absolutely appropriate to be going through all those expectations of bad things that are about to happen, and then the body is going to be responding to that expectation. And then it's just going to make whatever is going on that much worse for the individual.
Absolutely. So now I've collected all these stories about that, and I think maybe one of the things we should work on is maybe putting together something that we can make available to the community a whole to try to prepare it, you know, I don't want to say battle, but that's how we feel. Maybe using some of the techniques that they maybe has come out of what we've learned from PSTD or what you've learned from your firefighters. I think I have a project for you.
Well, and I think that it's a really, really cool idea because it's very practical. And that's one of the things that's unique about these approaches that go directly to the body and sort of bypass all the talking that happens in therapy. And I'm not I'm not criticizing therapy at all. I'm just saying sometimes approaches that go directly to the body are what's called for. And so if you're going into a really frightening situation, and you can because you've learned and built confidence in a technique that goes directly to the body and helps it relax. That's a powerful intervention for a person, and it makes a person feel a little bit more in control of their own life. Because, and I'm sorry to kind of backstep here a little bit, but mm-hmm. in trauma, in that world, what happens in the blink of an eye is that you feel like you've lost control of your world, of your life. And in the case of a patient dealing with a chronic illness, like we're talking about with sickle cell, not only does a person feel out of control with what's happening around them, you know, as far as what happens when they get to the ER, how are they going to be responded to, what are the doctors going to do, are they going to receive the help that they need, all of those horrible questions that are going through the individual's mind, they're feeling out of control of what's going on within their own bodies. And that, you know, you can't get away from that. You can't right. fix that. But if you can learn some techniques that help you regain some sense of control of what's going on within you, now you put yourself on a little different path where you've given yourself an opportunity to feel, hey, you know what? I do have some control of some things that are happening right now, and that will alleviate fear and anxiety, and that's absolutely normal and natural.
One of the things that I remember you talking to me about that really helped me was once we said, okay, and I'm going to say we because collectively we did. It was I had stress in my life. I certainly had trauma, that there were things that were normal just in being a person living, right? And being a mother and a worker and being in a relationship. There were things that were going to happen. I don't know if you call them triggers, but there were things that were going to happen that could potentially push me over up above that 10-point scale. We had the 10-point scale. And you taught me to recognize what those were so that I could use some of the techniques before I encountered them. For example, I knew, well, there was one terrible thing. I knew I was going to have to let Casey go visit her dad. And, you know, we were divorced. And that was traumatic for me because I felt he was not very responsible. And so we knew that was going to happen. And so there were some things that you had me do to prepare myself so that when it happened, I didn't go over the 10. And I'm just wondering if we could, you know, with the chronic illness, if there is something we can do for us, because we have this problem of waiting and waiting and waiting to go to the hospital because we know it's going to be bad. And so we wait until we absolutely have to go, and then we're in this situation. So I'm wondering if there's some sort of techniques that we can use that can encourage us to go to the hospital sooner. Can we get to that point where we're going, not because we're in so much pain we have to go, but that we feel that going is something that we are controlling as opposed to something we're doing because we're reacting to the pain?
Yeah, oh man. You know, what a horrible dilemma you've just described, because we will take care of ourselves, you know? It may not look like that's what's happening to an outside observer, but we will take care of ourselves. And if going to the hospital has taken on meaning that that's a worse place to be than where you are right now, the level of pain that you're in right now, then you're not going to the hospital. You're going to continue to stay where you are, because from that perspective, that's taking care of oneself, because the other thing is just that much worse. And that's just such a horrible tragedy because, rationally,